How would you feel about someone placing an implant in your brain? Well, it's less science fiction and now increasingly a reality. Today on Business Daily with me, Jane Wakefield, on the BBC World Service, I'll be asking if chips in brains could ever become a commonplace procedure. And I'll be hearing how the big tech firms are betting on a future with human enhancement at its heart.
What would be wrong with having more brain power? I would certainly like to have more brain power from time to time.
This is not getting a flu shot or getting a tattoo. This is a brain implant.
Business Daily from the BBC. Some 180,000 people around the world have brain implants for conditions such as Parkinson's disease, epilepsy, and even obsessive-compulsive disorder. Take Matt Eagles, who has been living with an implant for years. He explains.
I've had juvenile onset Parkinson's disease now for 43 years. I've been told I've got a good version of Parkinson's, if you can call it Parkinson's good at all. 12 years ago in September, I had deep brain stimulation because the medication was simply not working adequately enough for me. And it's really, really helped. It's enabled me to do a lot of things that perhaps I wouldn't have been able to do had I not had the surgery. And those electrodes are attached via a wire to a pulse generator within my chest, and the two communicate with each other and disrupt the electrical signals in my brain and help me to walk properly.
So describe how it has changed your life.
It's quite an easy one, this, really. It's given me my dignity back. I know that sounds a strange thing to say, but when you struggle to turn over in bed at night, which people take for granted, you can't get out of bed to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. Just to be able to do that is a huge plus for me. It's given me my confidence back as well. For example, I was an official accredited photographer at the London 2012 Olympics and an accredited football photographer. It's enabled me to travel the globe extensively as well. And also, of course, I've got married since I've had it, so that's a good thing. That's probably the best thing that's happened to me, I would imagine.
Now, for the first time, brain implants have been approved by the US Food and Drug Administration for treating people with drug addiction. The first patient, Jared Buckhalter, has struggled with substance abuse for more than a decade, with many relapses and overdoses. He had the brain implants inserted at a hospital in West Virginia in November and will be carefully monitored by a team of experts over the next 2 years. Three more volunteers will also have the procedure. Lead doctor Ali Rezai explained more about what they did.
My name is Ali Rezai. I'm the executive chair of the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute. So we're using a brain pacemaker or brain implants to help those with severe opioid addiction. Individuals who failed all previous treatment options and they are devastated from the addiction and have tried medications and behavioral therapy and inpatient and outpatient and residential approaches and they've failed them because addiction is a brain problem over time. So there are specific parts of the brain that are electrically malfunctioning, causing the increasing drug-seeking behavior. The hypothesis, and this is approved through the National Institute of Drug Abuse, funding through it, is to implant the pacemaker in a part of the brain involved in reward generation to calm the overactivity of that area to reduce the cravings. So we did the first implant in the U.S. last week in a patient who was a 33-year-old gentleman who since age 15 was taking opioids because of a football accident, so he had a shoulder surgery. And as in many other cases, people take opioids for a surgical procedure, and it has highly addictive components. And you know, addiction is a complex entity that involves genetic background, involves individual, family, psychosocial dynamics, and peers, and over time, the brain changes. So we're leveraging the physiological changes in the brain by looking at deep brain stimulation or brain pacemaker to regulate the brain function more so they have less cravings, as well as using this technology of magnetic stimulation to reduce the cravings in the brain or focused ultrasound. So three different approaches, all geared towards calming the electrical activity in the brain that's resulting in these individuals seeking drugs. And then the device is adjusted slowly over time by the psychiatrist, by the caseworkers, by those who are experts in addiction. And we do very careful adjustments to see if behaviorally the patients are getting better and their cravings are improved. There's already data that shows you can modulate the brain function and reduce the activity of the brain using a suite of technologies that are innovations, for example, in magnetic stimulation, called the transcranial magnetic stimulation, or focus ultrasound technology, or in the case of those who are very severe and disabled, not as a first or second line, but as an approach for somebody who's at the end of the road, and they can't get help there at the end of the road, so they often overdose, and it's a big problem in the U.S. Overdose deaths is the most common cause of deaths in those under 50. So it's a big problem, growing problem that we need to deal with, and finding new solutions for technologically.
Some people would say that the solution lies in changing social attitudes to drugs rather than messing with the brain. And I would imagine that this methodology isn't without controversy. How do you answer critics who say, you know, you shouldn't be interfering with people's brains, you should be finding other ways to deal with drug addiction?
So it's a good question. In terms of addiction, it's very complex. It starts early on. There's genetic elements. There is individual psychosocial dynamics, family dynamics, peers, and also for individuals who have lack of access to the treatments. If you don't get access to treatments early on, the brain keeps on changing. I'm not advocating for using brain implants in patients, but it's for those who have failed everything. And over many, many years, they failed medications, they failed behavioral therapy, social interventions. And despite that, and in this day and age, the best medication treatments, social interventions and others in severe addicts, the success rate is very low. So more than half the patients fail and they relapse in the long term. So what happens is that we need to find solutions because this is a life-threatening situation. And a brain pacemaker is one solution. Magnetic stimulation is another solution, or ultrasound stimulation. But the most important thing is to deal with the core element that has led to the addiction in the first place.
But Dr. Rezai is very clear that such technology should only be used for those with medical needs, and is concerned about firms like Facebook and Elon Musk's Neuralink getting involved. We've seen some big tech firms, big tech names like Elon Musk, Facebook, showing great interest in this kind of technology. What do you think about that, these firms getting involved in this area?
I think it's very good for science. We need more science to advance this field. But this technology is only reserved for those who have failed all other options. This is not for augmenting human beings. And that's very important. This is not a consumer technology. And surgery is not benign. It has potential complications.
Are you wary of companies like Facebook, which are a consumer-facing company, getting involved in this tech?
When it comes to applications of human beings, it needs to be very rigorous. It is heavily regulated, and it is reviewed by peers, by ethicists, and many others. So this is not, like I said, getting a flu shot or getting a tattoo. This is a brain implant with its own inherent risks. And it's only for those who have failed everything else and are without hope. And this technology has provided hope for many people with Parkinson's or tremor or epilepsy and others. And our hope is that in the same way, we can provide hope with those with severe addiction as well.
Facebook is supporting research that aims to come up with a headset that people can use to transcribe words at a rate of 100 per minute just by thinking. And Neuralink has applied to start human trials of its brain hacking devices, initially for patients with paralysis. Earlier this year, leading scientists from the UK's Royal Society said that devices that merge machines with the human brain need to be carefully investigated. The idea of people becoming telepathic, able to read the thoughts of others, was a realistic end goal and raises huge ethical issues, they said in a report. As part of the study, they asked people whether they thought such devices should be used purely on medical grounds or to enhance functions such as memory or physical strength. Dr. Sarah Chan from the Royal Society said it was often hard to tell the difference.
One of the concerns as neural interface technologies continue to develop and become used for a broader range of applications is to do with the information that they might collect. So in order to do its job in helping communication between your nervous system and your body or the outside world, a neural interface device will have to collect information about what's going on with your nerve signals and what's going on in terms of your movements and what you're doing. And one of the questions is, well, what happens to that data.
And give us some examples of the thing that you could collect.
We're certainly a long way from the point where neural interfaces can read your thoughts or read your mind, so to speak. But they are able to detect things such as your mood, whether you're excited or stimulated by something. More pragmatically, the devices might also collect other data, including things like where you are, what kinds of things you're doing. And so there might be concerns around that data being made available to anyone and everyone.
So when you heard that Facebook was getting involved in initially funding research and ultimately looking to create some kind of device that would connect people's brains, were you very alarmed?
Certainly there's a serious concern that this data is going to be of commercial interest. If a social media company can, for example, look at whether I'm more interested in certain things than others directly with an interface that looks at my brain activity, that's going to result in more targeted marketing. It might result in stereotyping, for example.
And what about the idea of sort of function creep? You know, it could start off as a medical use and then you could say, well, actually, why not, let's use this device to enhance humans that just want to have more brain power. Do you worry about that?
I don't think we should be as worried about so-called function creep as people suggest. What would be wrong with having more brain power? I would certainly like to have more brain power from time to time. So this idea that there's a sharp divide between what is medical and what's for health reasons and what's not medical and what's for so-called enhancement reasons, I don't think is necessarily true. I think we're excited about these technologies. We want these technologies because they think we're going to make our lives go better. And in some ways they may make our lives go better because they address a health condition or a medical problem they have. Or they may make our lives go better because they address a social problem. Let's say I'm very forgetful and a neural interface reminds me to take my keys when I go out of the house. Is that a medical device? Is that an enhancement? Or is it just something that makes my life better?
One of the questions that was raised in the report, if my memory serves me correctly, and I declare now I have had no neural interface put inside my brain, so my memory may not serve me correctly here, but it was about the question of what an enhanced person might say about humanity and whether we need to start sort of redefining what humanity is as we move to an era where more and more people are being enhanced. What are your sort of views on that question?
We are already enhanced humans. If you look at not just human health, but what we're able to do, the kinds of lives we're able to lead in comparison to humans of 200 or even 100 or even 50 years ago, I think it's pretty clear that we already enjoy enhanced status. One of the concerns with so-called enhancements, and I use that term cautiously, but one of the concerns is that by letting some humans gain advantages by using technology that not everybody can have, we're going to widen inequities, we're going to widen the gap between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. And I do think that's a serious concern, but it's a concern that we already face today.
But she added that the idea in future that big corporations might be able to read thoughts or moods should give us pause. For Dr. Rezai, the benefits of the technology could be huge, but it should remain the preserve of doctors. You mentioned ethics, and I wonder if you thought about sort of function creep here. You know, if this is successful with addiction, then perhaps it could be used to treat mental illness. You know, where do you sort of draw the line as to where this technology goes?
So this technology has been used now for over 30 years. 180,000 people in the world have brain implants, for example, for the treatment of Parkinson's or shaking tremor, or for epilepsy. It's FDA approved and CE mark in Europe approved for epilepsy, and it's also approved for obsessive compulsive disorder, which is also a brain disorder. So this is because of years of research that demonstrates benefits in reducing the anxiety in those who are severely affected by obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's also being explored for people with severe depression. Behavioral conditions, behavioral health conditions, they involve the brain, whether it's anxiety, mood, depression, addiction. And for those who have failed medications or other treatment options, this is an option to explore. And a lot of these individuals, these are life-threatening conditions. So it's not just for, you know, this is surgery. It's got some complications and risks. So it's not like getting a tattoo or getting a flu shot. This is a surgery that requires a complex of understanding a large team, and the patient and the family have to be very clear about the risks and potential benefits before they sign up.
But for others, including Professor Noel Sharkey of the University of Sheffield here in the UK, any brain enhancements designed to improve cognitive function rather than treat existing issues should be regarded with extreme caution.
I would draw a distinction between therapeutic use of technology and enhancement. You can have deep brain stimulator that will detect an early signs of an epileptic seizure and then tickle the cortex and stop the seizure from happening. All very good. But the idea of plugging things into ourselves to make ourselves smart or enhance us in different kinds of ways seems absurd to me. What worries me about it is that everybody talks about this incredible journey and having memory enhancement, and I'm not sure how they're going to do it, how it's going to plug into the brain. But even if you could do it, imagine you have these modules going into your head and nobody knows what the implications are. And I'm very concerned, for instance, I know that human memory, we don't have a great memory, but part of that means that we can abstract. So we're very good at abstract reasoning as humans. So the details have to fade away.
Do we need sort of ethical rules now to sort of sort this problem out, or is it something we just have to wait and see with?
We should never wait and see. And I get sick of wait and see. And what I'm for, and my Foundation for Responsible Robotics, is all about ethical design of the equipment. So you think about the problems in advance and you design the ethics into it.
Right now, brain hacking is in its early stages, reserved for skilled doctors to use on patients with critical conditions. But will there be less invasive devices in future? Ones that fulfil the science fiction promise of telepathy? Ones that offer to download information directly into our brains? Ones that can transmit information about our moods and thoughts to corporations hungry for ever more data? And is that a future we'd embrace, or a nightmare vision of humanity stripped bare? Will our brains be effectively for sale to the highest bidder? That's all from me, Jane Wakefield. Follow me on Twitter, at Jane Wakefield, and also don't forget to download our podcast.
Hello, this is Kevin Fong from 13 Minutes to the Moon, and I've got a present for you. Our award-winning podcast telling the epic story of the Apollo 11 moon landing was beautifully accompanied by the music of Oscar-winning composer Hans Zimmer. In a special extra episode, Hans will be telling us how he wrote the theme.
All we're doing with the music is we're opening the door a little crack and say, OK, now let your imagination run free.
And you can even download the track for free. That's 13 Minutes to the Moon from the BBC World Service. Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't heard the series yet, you'll find it all there.